Welcome to the Blue Security Podcast, a weekly podcast for information security defenders, where we bring you discussions on best practices, tools, and implementation for enterprise security. Now, here are your hosts for today's show, Andy Jha and Adam Brewer.
Welcome to another episode of the Blue Security Podcast. I'm Andy, your host.
And I'm Adam, your co-host.
This is episode 187, and so for 186 episodes previously, I have never really had an errata section. And this is the first time I wanted to go back and really clarify something that we talked about last week. So last week, Adam and I had mentioned that we're encouraging listeners to move to EntraJoin because of hybrid EntraJoin, maybe not offering continuous device attestation. And I mixed up a little bit because one of our listeners brought to my attention this week of a specific scenario. So if you're co-managing devices like with SCCM and Intune, and you're at hybrid EntraJoin, and you've offloaded that compliance workload from SCCM to Intune. So now Intune is doing that compliance checking, but you're still in the hybrid EntraJoin state. And you're using conditional access for compliant devices, then you do have that same security posture as you would with an EntraJoin device and continuous device attestation. The one condition that, specifically to this listener, they were doing a conditional access policy with both hybrid EntraJoin as a condition requirement and compliant devices. So the conditional access policy said require all. You know, you have the option of requiring all conditions or requiring at least one of the conditions for a conditional access policy. And they were requiring hybrid EntraJoin and compliant devices. And while I think that's okay and it works, I think if you got to a compliant device state and that's your requirement, that's probably the only thing that you need at that point. Because think about like moving to EntraJoin in the future, you would have to change that compliance policy and possibly lose a little bit of security. So I think if you've already gone to the compliant device state and that's your condition of accessing company data, regardless of the device identity, which is hybrid EntraJoin or EntraJoin, and in this case, if you're hybrid EntraJoin, if you offloaded that compliance to Intune, it's a compliant device. I think that's probably good enough. That is where you need to be. And then you can move that device identity, the EntraJoin, in the future without having to change your conditional access policy.
We did what we encouraged listeners and viewers not to do, which is we did a little bit of conflating device identity and device management. And as we always talk about, they are actually two different concepts. Now, I think part of the reason we link them together is because, generally speaking, if our customers are still doing hybrid joined devices, they are also probably not very mature in a co-management state, or if they are, they're not leveraging that for device compliance. And so a lot of this is to truly encourage moving forward. We just say move it all at once, do this and this at the same time. But it is fair to point out, which is what we're here doing now, that you can get to that state where you're consuming that device compliance check through Intune without changing your device identity. They can remain hybrid joined and do that. And I think you can even get to that state without putting yourself in a position to do a lot of rework later. It's all work along the path. So I think there's value in doing it that way. But what I am always concerned about is, do we keep kicking the can down the road? Are we continuing to invest in hybrid join more and more? When are we going to rip the Band-Aid off? And I think that's part of what we are getting at, is that's what really needs to happen. And again, fair to point out, they're two different things. So I agree with you, Andy, in the last part about the conditional access policies. While theoretically, this service will let you require both hybrid EntraJoin and compliant device, I don't think you need both, and I don't think you get tremendous security benefit from both. I see them as steps on a maturity curve. I used to advocate for customers many years ago, back when this was still hybrid Azure AD join, back in the day, to at least get to that state. Start doing some attestation validation of your devices. And then as you mature, get into co-management, start using Intune for compliance checking, then migrate to that. I don't think there's a lot of benefit in looking for both. And if you do, like Andy pointed out, I think you're making more work for yourself in the future, because now you are going to have to turn that off at some point, the hybrid check, in order to migrate to cloud native enterjoin devices. And anytime it even gives the appearance that you are rolling back security, even if it's not meaningful security, that becomes a harder thing to do later than to just say, we have elevated our security game and we are switching to this now. So don't make more work for yourself later. I have seen organizations have a lot of pushback over removing controls that I would argue are delivering next to no security value, because there's still the perception that, well, even if there's a 1 out of 1 million chance this might stop someone, if we turn this off, we've reduced our security by a fraction of a million. And there's someone somewhere who's going to pick a fight over it. And I don't agree with that fight, but it will happen. So save yourself the headache later. See those as steps on a maturity curve. When you're ready for require compliant device, migrate to that control and stop looking for hybrid join.
I found an article this week as I was looking through some of the security news that the U.S. Health Department, the Department of Health and Human Services, is warning that cyber criminals are using social engineering tactics to target IT help desks across healthcare and public health sectors. So I thought it'd be a good chance to kind of revisit IT help desk security, because we've talked about this in the past, but there are some new ways to mitigate that. I wanted to discuss this because it was mentioned, I think, in another call that I had, or possibly a listener brought it up. And at the time, it wasn't in our show, so I wanted to mention it now. So these tactics that they're using now are targeting organizations' IT help desk by enrolling their own MFA factors by calling the help desk with some information, usually publicly available information about the employee, or stolen information like social security numbers or ID verification. And they're using that to try to verify the imposter employee and then convince the IT help desk to enroll a new device into MFA, therefore gaining access to the accounts. And of course, probably as well, like a password reset. So some of the things that have come up on ways to mitigate, to me, when this was brought up to me, it was like a no-brainer. And it was something I didn't even really think about. But if I were to go to a new company today and they didn't have some of these tactics in place, I would recommend that we do that immediately. Some of the things you can do is require a callback from the number that's listed on file, like with HR, like require a callback to the phone number. They're calling the IT help desk. It could be a spoof number. You don't know who's on the back end. So the IT help desk can say, okay, great. I'm going to call your number that's listed on file here. And, you know, you answer and then we'll verify that way. And that can be good. Technically, you know, if like it's a stolen SIM, then you might not have that verification available. So a video verification, we all use Teams today or Zoom or some sort of video conferencing software. You can just use your company software and say, we're going to do a video verification right away. Now, they could say, we don't have access to our computer because we can't log in now or something like that. Well, in that case, you probably should require an in-person visit. So that's kind of the steps of like escalation. Let's start with a callback from the number listed on file. Let's do a video verification to make sure that, you know, it's actually you. And if any of those don't work, then require a in-person visit. You could also have a supervisor verify any type of request for a password reset or MFA enrollment, and also notification. So getting an email that a new MFA device was enrolled is also very good. In fact, I think, I can't remember which attack it was, but there was an attack that happened in the last couple of years where the employee got a new MFA device enrollment email and they said, hey, I didn't do that. And they contacted their IT department, escalated to information security, and then they discovered that the company was breached. I believe it was Mandiant or something like that. That was a few years back. But requiring a notification, like for us, when we enroll a new device into management, we get an email, our manager gets an email. And so those little notifications can help, because it just, if you did it, you're getting something and saying, oh yeah, I did that. But if you didn't do it, it's an immediate red flag that you can escalate. And then, of course, train your help desk to try to identify any of these tactics. But also, I think very importantly, I would have a zero tolerance policy, a zero exceptions policy for this type of password reset, MFA re-enrollment. I'm going to do a callback. Oh, I can't do one. Okay, let's do a video call. Can't do that. Okay, then you're going to have to come in. I can't do that. Well, then we can't do this. We can't reset your password. We can't reset your MFA. You got to make the time to do this. So I think I would have that type of policy in place. And I think that would greatly help mitigate any type of these help desk attacks. Not 100%, of course, but for sure, I think the chances of something getting through would be greatly reduced.
You're only as strong as your weakest link. I was staying in a hotel last weekend, and I usually like the mobile key on my phone. Just, it's easier to carry my phone around with me sometimes than remember where the key is. And for whatever reason, whenever I stay at a Marriott property, it doesn't automatically provision. I have to go to the front desk every time and ask. So I went to the front desk and said, hey, can you provision my mobile key? And they said, sure. What room number are you staying in? Well, number one, you're not supposed to have people say their room number verbally, nor is the front desk supposed to say it verbally. That's not supposed to be shared because it's within earshot. So strike number one. Strike number two, okay, never asked for any ID verification. Now, it's going to go to my phone, which is already signed into my account. So probably okay, because I've already done the validation on my end. But I still think anytime you're talking about room access, you should validate a photo ID. Number three, she provisioned another physical key, which I didn't ask for, and handed it to me. So I walked up to the front desk, said, I'm staying in room 619 or whatever it was. And she handed me a physical key, no ID validation required. This sorts of thing happens all the time. And this could be your help desk doing the same sort of thing where you put all these controls in place and all of this great security engineering. You've thought of every detail, dotted every I, crossed every T. And then your help desk, someone calls up and says, hey, I'm a doctor. I don't have time for this. Reset this. And it immediately jumped out to me that this was Department of Health and Human Services, and they're targeting healthcare environments. And any environment where you have like a really senior level person that is in some way seen as unassailable, like you can't burden them, lawyers, doctors, those sorts of things, they can oftentimes just kind of throw their weight around and get what they want. And they're accustomed to that in that environment. And that's where your help desk, like Andy talked about, just there are no exceptions. I don't care who you are, how powerful you are. This is our policy. This is to protect the company. This is to protect everyone. And that needs to be followed every time. And you see it all the time. You don't have to look far to find opportunities where this level of security falls down. In fact, the extra ironic part was that the people next to me were complaining to the other person at this hotel front desk because a unhoused person had gone in their room and taken a shower in their room, actually. And so they were literally having a physical security breach and reporting it, while this other lady handed me a key without validating my ID. So that was a suboptimal experience, to say the least, but it illustrates how important this stuff is. And this is your last and oftentimes weakest link. And so you really need to shore it up here. I love the concept of video verification. Andy, why not even allow like a FaceTime? FaceTime's end-to-end encrypted. If you can get on a FaceTime and show me your physical ID and I can see that you match your picture on the corporate directory, that's probably pretty solid too. I mean, any legitimate person will take the steps to validate their identity. Any attacker will find every excuse to throw up on why not to. So I think you can find a way to get together and validate their identity, but force them to do it. This is not the time to just be a matador, wave the red cape and then jump aside. Like you gotta be a blocker here. You gotta box out. This is your defense. It matters.
I really liked how you slipped in suboptimal into the conversation. Always a great use. But I love the call out of FaceTime. Like, I didn't think of that either, right? A method of verification that's outside of the company bounds. So FaceTime or Signal or WhatsApp or something like that. Any of those.
You can get a video app on your phone and call in. I don't have a device with a camera on it is a pretty invalid excuse at this point. And if that's really the case, maybe I'm not ready to reset your identity anyways.
Okay. So the final thing I wanted to talk about is certifications, because I saw this tweet this week and it showed an information graph, an infograph of all the different certifications. And it literally was an eye chart on how many certifications there are out there. And this tweet talked about how essentially it was great to try to get new people into cybersecurity, develop them and grow them. But then certifications became this huge business. There's boot camps for certifications. There's cost of annual fees, CPEs, webinars, events, not to mention the cost of the test itself can be, you know, extremely expensive. And so, you know, I was thinking about it myself, how much money I spent on going to conferences. Do I really learn anything at these conferences? You know, a lot of times I go into these sessions and it's stuff that I could be learning just from reading an article or watching a YouTube video or something else like that, or listening to a podcast. I'm not really learning anything. When Adam and I started this podcast, you know, there are a lot of information security podcasts out there. And so our goal initially was to, and I hope we've tried to carry this goal throughout the years that we've had this, was to have at least one takeaway, something that you can go and check your environment on or implement in your environment, and not just be a regurgitation of the news that's happening. And so that was modeled after one of my favorite conferences that I've gone to many times, which is hosted by Quest. It's called the Experts Conference. And there I learned practitioner level things, where each session I went to was like, hey, here's something you can do for your environment. Here's how to do something. And I think those are super valuable, but that's not the majority of conferences out there. So I think the amount of time that you're spending traveling and going to these conferences and then having to document the CPEs and paying the maintenance fees and taking the test, like, are you really actually getting any value out of these certifications? And so I'd argue probably very little, in my opinion, but there are a few good options out there. I think the ones for like AWS and for Microsoft are very good. If you're a Microsoft-centric shop, the Microsoft ones are very good. The AWS ones are very good, and they're very cost-effective. They're not like thousands of dollars. You know, the Microsoft ones are around like $165. The Amazon beginning ones are like $100. Even their middle ones are like $150. So those are very good. And the one thing that I think is important is, for me, I don't take certifications to try to learn anything. I think maybe if you're trying to begin your journey in information security or IT, you might learn a few things and then take the certification. But at this point in my career, I'm just doing it to certify something I already know. Like, I've been doing these things, and then some organization's like, oh, are you certified in this? Well, okay, I guess I'll go and get the certification for it and take the test. But it's, you know, maybe a little bit of studying, but it's stuff I've already done. I already know how to do. And I just have to like learn how to take that test to get the stamp to show somebody else that I know how to do the thing. So I'm letting some of my certifications expire. Like, I have a Security Plus one. I'm just tired of paying the annual fee and gathering the CPEs. But I think there are some good ones for beginners, right? The CompTIA ones, like Security Plus, Network Plus, there's a Cybersecurity Analyst Plus. Those are some good ones, like generally, if you're just trying to get one and break into the industry. The CISSP is still kind of widely regarded as the one to have if you need one. I actually don't have one, but you do. It requires 5 years of relevant experience to even like get certified in that. You can take the test, but you need 5 years of documented experience. SANS, I've heard, is very good, but they're super expensive, like $3,000 to $4,000 just for the exam itself. And then, you know, if you're into like pen testing and red teaming, I think really the only one that most people look for is the Offensive Security Certified Professional, the OSCP. That's often regarded as the gold standard. Although I personally really like TCM Security. That one's owned by Heath Adams. He's a well-regarded hacker, cyber mentor. He's a veteran. And they have some great training and certifications on their site. Everything from pen testing to mobile pen testing to malware researcher, OSINT researcher. And they're not trying to really like make money. I think the cost of their exams are fairly reasonable and they allow free retakes. And they have junior ones to advanced ones. And so those are some options, I think. But all overall, people have come to me and asked me what certifications I think you need. I wouldn't like lose any sleep over it. I think having one or two is probably good enough, and then try to get experience in the thing that you're trying to do and go from there. And if you're having problems like getting interviews or getting hired because you don't have certifications, I really think, you know, this is really to the HR folks, to the hiring managers, like look past that, right? Like I think it's a good, I guess, gauge if they have one or two, but really relative experience and the ability to learn, because how fast things are changing in today's age, it's not really about what you know. It's about the capacity and ability to continuously learn.
Mm-hmm. I personally hold 11 certifications. I have paid for 0 of them. So Microsoft paid for me to get certified ethical hacker. I completed that. And then I've taken a slew of Microsoft ones because they're free for employees to take. And so my theory is, why not? Let's see if I can pass it. And I've passed every exam on the first try but one, which I forget which one that is, SC200, Andy? Yep. Yeah, you and I are in the same boat. Took us more than once to get through that baby, but we did. I also failed certified ethical hacker the first time too. but I got through that as well. And everything you said rings true for me. The Microsoft ones you can renew for free now too. So, and you can renew without like being in a formal test setting. The renewal is not officially open book, but there's nothing that stops you from looking at references while you take this renewal. And you don't have to pay anything. So it's really nice. Now you can keep a Microsoft one in perpetuity as long as you take the renewal exam every year. And they're now annual renewals. Certified Ethical Hacker is just a nightmare to renew. They want money every year. I have to go, like you said, talk about all the professional development I'm doing and the system's gross and it's a mess. Most people did not renew it. I actually did go through renewing mine. I don't know if I'll do it another cycle, but I did it once just to kind of see what it was like. I really like everything you called out, just in terms of in today's cybersecurity world, more than ever, I need your ability to continuously synthesize new information. And when you look at some of these exams, I have a family member who was just doing Security Plus, and she shared with me some of her training material. I'm like, ooh, this is going to be fun. Like, throw one at me. Let's try it. And she's like, all right, take this one. And it was like asking me how to build a crossover Ethernet cable. And I looked at her and said, you will never need to do this. She's like, why? I said, because everything is auto-sensing today. There is no network equipment that requires a crossover cable unless it's like from the 90s. Because today, you just connect a patch cable and it auto-negotiates. Does this need to be crossover or is it straight through? So they are literally teaching you completely inapplicable knowledge you will never, ever, ever use. And there were a couple more examples of like, you'll never use this. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say this to you out loud because you're studying for this. But my goodness, there's material in here that's completely irrelevant. And it's like, I would want you more to learn this, 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 and this, you know, to be prepared to go into the cybersecurity business. It's dunking on certs is a tale as old as time. I think you did a pretty even-handed analysis of them. I would still want a CISSP. I would really like Microsoft to pay for it. So I keep hitting up my manager every year saying, hey, pay for this for me. I want to do it. And haven't gotten the yes yet, but I'm going to keep trying. But otherwise, like for me, I've never personally paid for a cert. And on my career path now that I'm more in the sales part of the world, I'm not sure it's terribly relevant, but I do like to show up when I talk to customers and demonstrate, hey, I kind of know what I'm talking about. I have technical certifications. I am a certified ethical hacker. I've done some of this stuff. I at least have a conceptual understanding of how the sausage is made. But I think for our listeners who are security practitioners and security professionals, there's always that cat and mouse game of what is going to draw the eye of the recruiter to get you in. And sometimes they help and sometimes they don't. And everyone kind of has different opinions of them. I will always say, talking about not conventions, what's the word you were talking about? When you go to a place and everyone's learning.
Conference.
Thank you. I was just totally blanking on it. Conferences, there's a wide-held opinion that they're more for social networking and for meeting people than they really are about learning material. Because I don't know about you all, but I don't learn well from having someone lecture at me for 50, 60, 90 minutes. Like that will, if you're a good presenter, you'll put on that light bulb in my head and make me go, ooh, this is interesting. But then what I do is go in the rabbit hole, you know, go back, plug into the matrix and start just like, give me everything. I want to know all the things about this. And if you get my interest, I will go do that. But that's how I really learn, is like learn it that I'm interested in it, go down the rabbit hole, then start applying it. Like, oh, well, let's build a test environment. Let's try this out. Let's see how this works. And everyone's different. Some people can learn really well in that format. For me, it's kind of like building a punch list of things I want to go learn later. Because I'm not really learning there. It's highlighting things I want to learn later. And that's what they do well for me. And then, of course, just meeting people. That's what conferences are really good for, at least in my humble opinion. So if you're not wired that way, then you may have a different opinion. But that's the beauty of the world. You know, I don't know if we came to a definitive answer in certs, which nobody ever has and nobody ever will. You got to be adaptable to you, kind of your situation. If you need ways to make your experience stand out, if you want to bolster up your resume a little bit, you know, go get a cert or two. It's not going to hurt you other than maybe in the pocketbook, which certainly agree, it can be egregious. I will just a plus one and a final thing Andy said. If you're an AWS practitioner or a Microsoft practitioner, if you're already using this stuff, maybe go try some of the exams for things you think you already know, because they're inexpensive. And in a lot of cases, you can probably pass them if you're already doing the thing. The Microsoft ones in particular are very much, if you're in the service doing the thing, you should be able to pass the exam. It is a validation of what you know, which I think, to your point, Andy, is what they should be. And they really are in that case. They will ask you some weird esoteric stuff occasionally, but for the most part, they're pretty good. If you know the thing, you will know the exam and you'll be all right. Depends on your style. Some people are really good test takers and can just go in and kind of figure it out. Some people, at least seeing the exam helps you understand what you're trying to do. So either way, there's not a ton of downside to it, other than, of course, if you have to pay for a retake. But oh well. It happens.
Yeah, I think
it happens to all of us.
One of the things that we can agree on is that in cybersecurity, we're never going to agree on everything. And even the certifications or the knowledge that you have, like you mentioned, you know, your family member is taking the test now and she's getting asked some weird stuff that you're never going to use. I was listening to a podcast earlier this week and it was shared. Grippo, I think her last name is. We talked about her before, but she said getting into cybersecurity, like her recommendation would be to learn TCP/IP. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, the amount of times that I've used TCP/IP is fairly small when it comes to cybersecurity. Like, I need to know what IP numbers are, what subnets mean, but I've never had to subnet myself. And I certainly don't, you know, like you only need to know like certain layers, right? Like physical layer, application layer, and maybe the network layer. And that's pretty much it, you know, layer two, layer three, and you're good. Like no one really talks about the other layers, like six, you know, five and six. So it's like, I haven't really used that in my job or in my experience. And so it's like, if she were to tell me you need to know TCP/IP to get into cybersecurity, that's the basics, I would say probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But she did say, you know, maybe study some of the frameworks like RFC 1918, and you could gain some credibility if someone's trying to do something and you're like, well, you know, according to RFC 1918, that's not the correct way to do it. Like, just the naming conventions for devices was one thing that she mentioned. So I think, again, when it comes to cybersecurity, people, a lot of people have opinions. I think the most important thing is what you said, Adam, is be adaptable. See what your job is actually. Try to learn that job, maybe certify what you have to do on that job, and look for things that your employer or a future employer might want you to be certified in, and go from there.
I you made me think of one final thing. I just saw a tweet from friend of the show, Christina Murillo, and she recently wrote the book on Zero Trust Network Architecture. I need to check it out. It's an O'Reilly publication. She defined, in her opinion, Zero Trust Network Architecture, which I thought was interesting because she said, and it's obviously been co-opted by a lot of sales teams, a lot of companies pushing tools. She said, there is no one tool or no one company that can make you Zero Trust. You know, it's reminds me of that scene in Friends when Ross is talking to Rachel and Phoebe about Unagi and say we are Unagi. It's like, Unagi is not something you are. It's something you have. It's a state of total awareness. Anyhow, Zero Trust is not something you buy. It's something you achieve. It's a destination. But she defined it very succinctly. Zero Trust is essentially the antithesis of the traditional perimeter-based network security model. It is the opposite of that. It's the evolution beyond that. And so I think a lot of times when you talk about this, like, you need to really know TCP/IP, you need to understand SYN and ACK and SYN-ACK and all that, that comes from a perimeter-based security model. When you kind of move beyond that, I think that becomes less important. And so you get in that balancing act then of, well, we're all trying to get to this state, but where are we today? And so if I'm defending the organizations of now, there are plenty of organizations that still have a perimeter-based security model. They should evolve that. But if I'm defending them now, if I'm protecting them now, this is meeting them where they are. And so I think that's the other part we have to balance as well, of meeting your potential employers where they are. Obviously, we all want to aspire to this higher state, but where are we now? And how can we protect them now? So that's the other balancing act.
Great conversation today. That's all we had. And that's our show. Thanks for watching and listening as always. Our contact information will be in the show notes, as well as links to the articles that we used for our conversation today. If you have any questions or topics or comments on our show, please find us in the notes section. Our emails and socials are there. Thanks. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to the Blue Security Podcast. Please check out the show notes, catch up on episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Find Andy on Twitter at AJawZero and Adam at AJBrewer. See you at our next episode.